Okay, Perek Memvav Pasuk Gimel. The story up to now. The brothers come home. First, Yaakov didn't believe that Yosef is alive. Then all of a sudden he sees the wagons. He understands that Yosef is alive. He says, okay, I'm going to go down to Israel. And the way he brings korbanos, he brings sacrifices to Hashem. Hashem appears to Yaakov Avinu in the middle of the night, and he says, Yaakov, Yaakov, and he says, I'm ready. You know, whatever you want, I'm here. So he says over here in Pasuk Gimel the following. V'yemen, he says, Anecha l'kei Avraham Avicha, I am the God of your father, Avraham. I'm sorry, the God of your father. Al teira medam mitzrayma, don't be afraid to go down to Egypt. K'ilgai godol asimcha sham, I'm going to make you for a very great nation. Which, even though the Pasuk doesn't say it, but the implication of the Pasuk is very clear, that Yaakov Avinu was afraid to go down to Mitzrayim, and that's why Hashem had to tell him, don't be afraid to go down to Mitzrayim. So even though the Pasuk doesn't say that Yaakov was hesitant, but obviously Hashem knew that he was hesitant. Now why did he not want to go down to Mitzrayim, obviously? Because he knows the other patriarchs, especially his father Yitzchak, were not in Mitzrayim. They were never left Eretz Yisrael. From the other opposite side, he wanted to go down to see Yosef. So from Yaakov's perspective, at least at the present, even though we see contradictory things in the Pasuk, that he really was thinking of going down there temporarily. And Hashem said to him, don't be afraid. Why? Because that's the only way you're going to become a big nation. The commentaries explain that in Eretz Yisrael, you cannot be a great nation. The only way you could become a great nation is dafka through the Yerida, dafka through the descent. The Zayah says, Yaakov Avinu was afraid to go down to Mitzrayim because he was afraid that the Shechina won't rest amongst the people because the Shechina doesn't rest in Chutz Loretz. So Hashem said, don't worry, when the Jews go down to Golus, as Chazal tells, Shechinta beGolus, the Shechina goes down with them. But Yaakov was afraid that God won't go down with them. And, you know, in Eretz Yisrael, God is with them and, so to speak, revealed. So Hashem said, don't worry about it. I'm going to go down with you also. Another thing the Mefarshim explained, Yaakov Avinu was afraid to go down to Mitzrayim because he knew that Hashem promised the land to the Jews. Yaakov Avinu was afraid that if he goes down to Egypt, the promise won't exist. He's going to lose the promise. So Hashem said to him, don't worry about it. I'm going to bring you back up. So therefore you will get the land and you'll become a great nation. In Chassidus it explains that only by descent do you reach a level that you would otherwise not be able to really you'd not be able to receive, or you wouldn't be able to get to that level. Dafka through going down in Golus, dafka through the descent, do you reach the Aliyah, do you reach the elevation. So Hashem is telling Yaakov Avinu basically the whole concept of the descent of the neshama in the body is the descent into Mitzrayim. Hashem promises to be with the neshama, and Hashem promises to reach a level of elevation that he could otherwise not attain. Anechi eded imcha Mitzrayma. Hashem says, I. And it's interesting, the concept of Anechi refers to the essence of Hashem. You know, Anechi is not Hashem, it's not Elohim, it's higher than Hashem and Elohim, it's the essence of Hashem. So he says, Anechi, the level of the essence of myself, Hashem says, Eidit Imcha Mitzrayma, will go down to you with you to Mitzrayim, meaning, I will protect you, V'anechi Olcha Gam Olay, and I will also elevate you, V'yesef Yoshis Yodi Alanecha, and Yosef is going to literally means place his hand on your eyes. What does this mean? So, Rashi says, no, he doesn't say, the other Mefarshim said it's an expression that Yosef is going to close his eyes after he passes away. What do you mean Yosef will put his hands on your eyes? There are many different interpretations of the way they're learning it. Meaning, he's going to close your eyes after you pass away. Another interpretation is he's going to take care of him. He personally will take care of you, not with other people. Other people say Yosef, who will survive you, will look after your affairs. What is his promise basically to Yaakov, that Yosef will outlive him? If you remember before, we learned that Yosef was told that if any one of his children die in Yaakov's life, Yaakov was told, if any of your children die in your lifetime, you will not go to Gan Eden. So Yaakov Avinu was still afraid. That's why he was very upset when Yosef died, when he thought Yosef died, and then Binyamin, I mean, he thought he was finished with Olam Haba. So basically the concept is that Hashem says to him, don't worry, Yosef will close your eyes when you die, meaning Yosef will outlive you, so you'll be able to go straight to Gan Eden. Now, there's an interesting concept over here about the Shechina in Golus. Because Unklus, over here on the Pasuk, I will go down with you and I will bring you up. Normally, Unklus doesn't interpret like the Unklus normally defines it more figuratively. Here, Unklus defines it literally, that it means God will actually go down with him to Golus, and God will take him out of Golus. Which means, basically, that God finds himself in Golus. This is one of the concepts of the Baal Shem Tov, of divine providence, that many people were of the opinion, many great tzaddikim were of the opinion, that how can you say God exists in very low places? Not only does God exist in low places, but he's existing in a place of evil and impurity and corruption. And how can you say God exists there? So many people want to say, it doesn't mean, it means, so to speak, and metaphorically speaking, whatever. Unklus learns simply, God will go down with the Jews in Mitzrayim. When the Jews lower themselves to Mitzrayim, Hashem is present. Even though the Golus, the Shechina is in Golus, but the Shechina is there. And for God himself, there is no difference if he's revealed or not revealed. The whole difference, if something is revealed or not, is only for somebody else. If you hide behind a curtain, you're no different if there's a curtain blocking you or there's not a curtain blocking you. The only difference is, does somebody else see you or not? But Hashem himself doesn't change whether there's coats of level after concealment of hiding, 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 that conceals godliness. That's only as far as we're concerned. So Hashem is telling Yaakov that even in the concept of Golus, the level of Anechi, the essence of Hashem, finds himself even in Golus. He may not be revealed. We may not see him because he might be covered. But just because he's covered doesn't mean he's not there. To give another analogy that the Alter Rebbe says in Tanya, if you hug somebody, you hug a person, and if it's cold outside, the person is, let's say, wearing a shirt and a jacket, a tzitzis, of course, a shirt and a jacket and a coat and a sweater even, okay? And you hug the person, nobody's going to come along and say, well, I didn't hug the person, I only hugged his coat. And the Alter Rebbe explains, why not? Because what's inside it all? The bottom line is, what are you hugging? What's inside of all the concealments and coverings is the person himself. And that's what you're hugging. And then the Alter Rebbe explains in time, he uses the lashon, it doesn't matter if you hug a king, whether the king is wearing one garment or many garments, what's inside everything is the body of the king. And this is what Hashem is telling Yaakov Avinu, I am going with you, and I promise you the same way to take you out. One second, you have to stop it for a second. Okay.
You say Hashem is every place, your place, no place, and
every place.
Still, any place. But still, when you are in the bathroom, you're not allowed to say Hashem's name, right?
Because it's
not a respectful place to say Hashem's name. That doesn't mean that Hashem's not there. Hashem is concealed. Can I bow this for a second? I'm not going to drink anything. Don't worry. One second. God is in this can?
Yeah.
If somebody davens to the can or bows down to this can, they're idol worshippers.
Right.
Correct? Now, if God's all over, isn't God in the can? Yes, he is. Isn't God in the table? Yes. Why can't I bow to the table? If Hashem's all over, why can I bow to the wall, to anything? I can bow to another person there. It's also God. What's the answer? God is there, but it's not the revelation of godliness. Okay? It could be so concealed, it comes to a point that it's impure, which means it's going against God. It's evil, which is fighting godliness. It's concealing godliness, right? That doesn't mean it's an idol. I mean, even an idol, Avodah Zarah, is existing because Hashem is in the idol keeping it existent. If Hashem would leave the idol, it wouldn't exist, right? According to the Baal Shem Tov. That doesn't mean you could bow down to the idol.
But when you bow, it's still concealed.
Huh?
When you bow, it's still concealed.
Correct, but we are giving credence to something which is not openly godliness.
Can you worship a Sefer Torah?
No. A Sefer Torah is not God. It's godly. But it's not God. A tzaddik is godly, he's not God. A Sefer is holy, it's not God. Okay? If you bow down to a Sefer, you're Aved Avodah Zarah. It's Avodah Zarah if you bow down to a Sefer. Yeah?
When you open up the Aron Kodesh on Yom Kippur to bow down during all those times, I would say Kohanim.
In fact, when they bow, they close it, by the way. No, they got to open it. Why? It's nothing to do. We're not bowing down to the Sefer Torah. Chas v'shalom.
So why do we need the Aron Kodesh over period?
So you have the same question. Why does a person have to daven in a shul? It's really the same question, right? Why does a person have to daven in a shul? The bathroom is also the house. Why does a person have to daven in a shul if a house has God also? What's the answer? The answer is quite obvious, and that is a house is used for a lot of other things. So holiness, it's not a place of soul holiness. You use it for eating and sleeping and work and a million other things. A shul is a place which is designated for davening. So therefore, there's a certain level of holiness that's revealed in a shul that makes it a holier place, a greater place, and therefore it's more apropos to daven there. Doesn't make it more holy. Why certain tefillahs you open the ark? The truth is, I can't tell you. I don't know. Maybe it's to stimulate the person to have more kavana. It's an important part of davening. Shemoneh Esrei is holier than Shema Kaleinu. For sure. Shemoneh Esrei is holier than Avinu Malkeinu. For Shemoneh Esrei, you don't open the ark when we daven Shemoneh Esrei. For Avinu Malkeinu, we open the ark. For Shema Kaleinu, you open the ark. It's a different concept. Maybe it's to stimulate the person, it's a unique time, whatever. But it doesn't make the davening, I mean, so to speak, it's like you open the door, you can get through easier. It's not that. What it is exactly, I'll tell you the truth, I don't know. But it's not that. It's not that all of a sudden the prayers are more accepted because the Aron Kodesh is open. It doesn't work like that. A place where godliness is revealed, because the place is used for godliness, that's a holier place to daven. And therefore, as Chazal tells, tefillahs are accepted easier there because it's a holier place. Yeah, you're not bowing to the wall. In shul, you're not bowing to the Aron Kodesh either. Yeah. You're bowing to Hashem. Baruch ato Hashem. Meidem anachnu loch. We're bowing to Hashem. We're not bowing to anything else.
Could it be that maybe we're using the Aron Kodesh as a witness?
I don't know if it's a kosher witness. It doesn't talk.
Yeah. I think it brings more attentiveness, maybe, and more seriousness.
That's what it is, but I'm saying it's not that... That the
casualty, you know?
It's more of it could be psychological. I don't know what it is.
Right.
I don't know.
It looks good.
Okay. Vayakam Yaakov Mirashava. Yaakov got up from Be'er Shava. So the question is, what does it mean he got up? Where does he get up from? So some of Farshim learn that he was actually bowing to Hashem, and he got up. He finished bowing to Hashem, and he got up by Yisro b'nei Yisrael, and he arose. Other interpretation of Vayakam is, it was in level of significance, meaning Yaakov had a hard time going down to Mitzrayim, and now he felt, you know, more joy and more enthusiasm about going, because Hashem promised him that he's going to go. He went up from Be'er Shava. The children of Yisrael picked up Yaakov, the father, Vestapam, the children, Vesneshem, and the wives, Vagolis, and the wagons, and Shosholach Parei, Losis Eser, the Parei sent to carry him. And if you just think for a second, this pasuk is complicated from beginning to end. I mean, there isn't a word in this pasuk that makes sense, by the way. I mean, simply meaning, first of all, just look at it. It says, Vayisum Bnei Yisrael is Yaakov Aviyam. Over the Bnei Yisrael, the next word is Yaakov. I mean, either Bnei Yaakov picked up Yaakov Avihim, or Bnei Yisrael picked up Yisrael Avihim. Right? And what do you mean they picked them up? What do you mean they picked them up? And also, the order of the babies, then the women. Okay, that order. Which we have to understand why it says in that order. And also it says in the wagons that Pari sent. A few psukim before, it just says the wagons that Yosef sent. So let the Torah make up his mind. Did Yosef send them or did Pari send them? A few psukim we learned last week that he saw the wagons that Sheshalach Yosef lost Yosef. So whose wagons are they and what's actually going on over here?
It's wagons that Paroi gave Yosef to give to his father.
Yeah, obviously, correct. So before though it says Pari, then it says Yosef, and now it goes back to Pari. It's like just interchanging over there. So the Mefarshim explains as follows. The brothers didn't see the gloomy future of Golos like Yaakov Avinu did. The brothers were excited. They're going down to see their brother who was the king of Egypt. They didn't see, like Yaakov Avinu foresaw, Golos. So they were on a very lofty level at this time. They were a very big high. They're going down to Egypt to see their brother and to live a good life. Yaakov foresaw Golos. So when Yaakov was picked up, he looked at it as Yaakov, a low level. Because now he realized the burden and the understanding. Granted, he realized it's the only way you could reach a higher level. But it's like a guy going into surgery. Only through surgery can you become better, but you still don't like the surgery. You know, you go gloomy into the surgery. Yeah, I tell you. Okay, you should know it. So it says, therefore it says, the sons of Yisrael picked up Yaakov. Another interpretation is that here going into Golos, they're called Bnei Yisrael. Why? Because why was he called Yisrael? Because he fought with the angel of Esav and he was overpowering, he was victorious. Now that the Jews are going down into Golos, they're going to be fighting Egypt, they're going to be fighting Goyishkeit, so they need the level of Yisrael. Yaakov, though, is mentioned again as the destiny of the Jews, that Golos causes the Jew to be the heel, not on a very lofty level. Okay, that's one thing. Another thing is, Vayisu b'nei Yisrael, is Yaakov Aviyam, the Medrash says that they actually carried him. They didn't carry him on the wagons. Yaakov, you know, they actually carried by hand the brothers. And if you notice, Vayisu b'nei Yisrael, is Yaakov Aviyam, the Pasuk says, and then it says, Vestapam Vesneshem ba'agolis. So the women and the children, they put into the wagons. Yaakov, out of respect to the father, you know, especially in the olden time, he used to carry the kings, you know, by hand. Similarly, what you found in the Mishkan, that all the Kelim of the Beis HaMikdash, of the Mishkan, they carried on the wagons. But the Arden, which is the holiest part of the Mishkan, they carried on their shoulders. So this is the Bnei Yisrael carrying Yaakov in this. And everything else, they did it by the wagons. Another interpretation says over here, if you remember before, when Yaakov was about to fight Esav, it says Yaakov carried all his children across the river. It says, Ve'yavireim, he carried them all over. So to repay Yaakov's kindness that he carried them, they carried him. Another interpretation of here, the Mefarshim say, it shows how Yaakov became frail from the 22 years of suffering. Early in Chumash, when Yaakov went to find the Shidduch, there was this big stone. You know, remember the story? And there all the shepherds had to come together and then move the stone. It was impossible to move. And Yaakov threw it off like you flip a cork off a bottle, like nothing. And now, Yaakov himself, according to another interpretation, the Yitaka went on the wagons. He couldn't even get himself up on the wagons. The boys had to pick him up on the wagons. Which shows how frail Yaakov became, and the toll that the 22 years of not seeing Yosef did to him. Another thing is that why is it Pare? Why does it say Pare? That Pare sent the wagons. Number one, Pare gave the order to send them. And this again is emphasizing that Yaakov came down to Egypt on the personal invitation of Pare. Pare sent to bring him, so he sent the... Give you an example. And this shows the American bluff. I love showing American bluff. It's so, I mean, I'm third generation American, but it still doesn't matter. You see a friend, You know, you see, for agency, oh, why don't you come for dinner? Yo, Owen, please come for dinner. You don't want him. You don't mean it. How do you know you don't mean it? Because if you meant it, you'd say, okay, at 5 o'clock, I'm going to send the car and I'm going to pick you up and you're going to come. That shows you mean it. When are you going to come? And the guy says, no, I'm so busy, thank God. You know, he can't come. That, you want somebody, what does the Torah teach you? What does the Torah teach you over here? Paddy wanted Yaakov to come. He sent wagons. He sent drivers. That's the way. If you invite somebody to do something, that's the way you do it.
What if you really don't want him?
Then you don't invite him. It's a shaila, by the way, in Shulchan Aruch, it's a shaila to do such a thing. The shaila is called Gneivas Das. Gneivas Das is you're stealing the person's mind by inviting him when you know he's not going to come. The Shulchan Aruch says you're not allowed to do that. Because he thinks you really want him and you don't. Because if you know he'd come, you wouldn't invite him. You only invite him because you know he's not coming, right? Everybody does that.
That's yeah. Not true.
You're not everybody. I said everybody does it.
You're special. I don't know. You don't want somebody, you don't invite.
Oh, yeah, right. Come on, do me a favor. You invite, I hope they don't come. You're a tzaddikus. You get the tzaddik award. Ooh, wow. For tonight's this year. But most of us are not such great tzaddikim. Shmuz, but don't invite the guy if you don't mean it.
There's a guy that you don't know next to a guy that you want to invite, so you tell him, okay, well, you're invited also. So you don't mean it, but if he comes, he comes.
He comes, you have no choice. You have no choice, he comes. Anyway, but the bottom line over here, you see an interesting, I mean, this to Mefarshim don't say, but you see just a simple lesson. Paddy really wanted Yaakov to come. And the truth of the matter was, it wasn't for holiness. He didn't want Yosef to leave. And you know, if Yaakov didn't come, Yosef's gonna leave, right? Obviously. So, but Paddy, bottom line is, he wanted him to come. So how do you get somebody to come? You send a car to pick him up. You know, you make up a time, you send, a limousine or whatever. Okay, Vayichu es Mikneyam, and now the Pasuk is saying that Yaakov took, as the expression goes, lock, stock, and barrel, Yaakov took everything down to Mitzrayim. Because as far as Yaakov was concerned, this was a permanent move. Okay? Vayichu es Mikneyam, and there's an interesting few points in this Pasuk. Vayichu es Mikneyam, they took the cattle, Vesrechushon, and all the properties, Asheroch Sheberz Canaan, that they amassed in the land of Canaan, Vayavayo Mitzrayim, and they came to Egypt. Now, why does it say over here that everybody came? It says, "Vayivel Yaakov Mitzrayim, Yaakov Cholzare Itay." When Yaakov left Israel to go to Be'er Sheva, it doesn't say he took everybody. He just says, "Vayisa Yisrael v'cholashalei came to Be'er Sheva." In Pasuk Aleph, right? In Pasuk Aleph, we just learned it says he took everything that Yisrael took everything that he had. It doesn't say that everybody came. So Nefashim explained that when Yaakov first left, the brothers weren't intending to go with him the whole way. They were only their intention was to go part way with him. Now already that Hashem told them to go and everything else, so then the brothers, then the Pasuk says, V'chozari to everything with him, all his possessions and so on. Another thing it says, why does it say the wealth that he amassed in the land of Canaan? He had other wealth also. He became very wealthy in Lavan. Lavan's house, he became very wealthy. Why does it say here that he only the property that he got in Canaan? So the Gemara says that Yaakov Avinu wanted to buy Maris HaMachpelah. And he had to buy off his share of Esav, because Esav had, from Yitzchak, there were two kids. So Esav would have one grave and Yaakov would have one grave. Yaakov wanted both graves. And he didn't want Esav there. So Yaakov took all the money that he made in Lavan's house and offered it to Esav to buy one grave in Maris HaMachpelah that belonged to Esav. And that's why...
What grave?
Maris HaMachpelah. Adam and Chava were there,
right?
Avram and Sarah,
yes.
Yitzchok and Rivka.
Okay.
Now they had two kids,
okay.
Right? One kid gets one grave, the other kid gets the other grave. No, that's the laws of inheritance.
You don't want to,
right?
The grave.
The grave. No, the grave.
The place to be
so Esav wanted to be buried in Maaseh Machpelah.
Right.
So Yaakov bought it from Esav for how much money? For all the money he made in Laban's house.
Mm.
And that's why later, when they were burying Yaakov and Esav came to complain, they said, we bought it from you. That was the whole story.
Not more you.
But you went right away.
Huh?
You went right away.
Who?
Inside. Esav.
The head went inside. Okay, so who else went with him? Banav, his sons, Bnei Banav, his grandchildren, Bnei Esav, his daughters, Bnei Banav, and his granddaughters, V'chol Zari, all his children, Hevi Ite Mitzrayma, he brought down to Mitzrayim. Now, basically it means, Hevi Ite, he brought with him to Egypt. In Mepharshim, some of them say, they didn't want to go, he brought them. Meaning he made them come. It doesn't say they came with him. Hevi Ita means he brought them.
I thought they wanted to go.
No, that, well, no. Originally they didn't want to go. Now, Yaakov and Esav said, you're coming. So Hevi Ita actually, he brought them. He brought them forcibly to Egypt.
Only the women?
No, well, everybody so far, according to this opinion.
They
it says Bonavim and they say everybody he brought. Some of Hashem learn the daughters he had to force and the granddaughters,
mm-hmm.
But the great children. But the Mepharshim say everybody he had to force to come. Right. Well, that's another reason why the sons go first and then the girls, because he separated completely.
What does it mean by his daughters?
Oh, so who are his daughters? Is unclear, because Lecheira Dina was the only daughter. So Rashi over here.
One boy, one girl. No?
Uh-huh. Well,
they married the sister, no?
So there's different opinions of who the daughters are. Okay, one opinion we'll soon learn that. Oh, really, we learned it already. I'm sorry. When Yaakov Avinu was comforted, and he refused to be comforted. One opinion says that Yaakov Avinu had twin girls born with each shevet. With Binyamin, two girls were born. So that's one opinion, that those refer to the daughters. Other people say Bnei Esav refers only to Dina. And we do find in Chumash, soon in fact, that the Pasuk says, Ubnei Don Chushim. Even though Don had one son, but the term many times calls, according to the flow of the language, Bnei Don Chushim, even though it was only one kid. So sometimes the Torah calls one many. So Bnei Esav Zaman Farshim Learn actually means Dina only. Zaman Farshim Learn, daughters refer to the daughters-in-law, because people call daughters-in-law daughter. Okay?
And Don really had only one son?
Don had only one son. Daughters doesn't say, so I don't know. Okay, the Ramban learns now by plural daughters. Yaakov's granddaughter is Yocheved and Sarach. So daughters refer to Yocheved and Sarach because again,
granddaughter.
Huh?
Who was the father of Sarach and?
Asher was the father of Sarach, and Levi was the father of Yocheved. Another interpretation, the Ibn Ezra says, that it's possible that Dina and Sarach had young personal girls that came with them. They took care of the girls. You have to understand, in a house of boys, the girls needed some extra protection, you know. So they used to have attendants, they used to take care of them. And they became like the adopted daughters. That's the way that Ibn Ezra learns in simply.
But Sarach and Yocheved are the granddaughters.
Huh? Yeah, Sarach and Yocheved were the two grandchildren. Even though Yocheved wasn't born yet. Yocheved was born when they actually came into Egypt. Now, what is V'chol Zareh already? If everybody is there, you count it, sons, daughters, grandchildren, what is V'chol Zareh? There were a few great-grandchildren. Chetzren and Chomel, the sons of Yehuda's son Peretz, were Yaakov's great-grandchildren. Mm-hmm. So V'chol Zareh means all his offshoots. Hevi Ita Mitzrayim, to make sure that nobody stayed behind in Mitzrayim. And like we said, the last group according to many Mefarshim, were the groups that he had to force to, that they should come into Mitzrayim. Okay, now the Pasuk says, Ve'el Shmeis B'nei Yisrael Aboyim Mitzrayim. These are the names of the tribes of the Jews that are coming in Egypt. And even though the Torah grammatically should have said that came to Egypt, past tense, but here the Torah says, Boyim, which are coming. Because that's the way the Torah speaks. The Mefarshim explained, when Torah speaks about an incident, the Torah speaks, even though Torah was written much later. Right? Hashem dictated Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu. So Hashem should have said to Moshe, Bo'u, that they came. But Torah speaks in the time frame of like when it's happening now. That's the way Torah speaks. So even though it happened, but it's basically, it was happening at the time.
What
does it mean? The what? That's what Rashi is saying. Why does it say present tense? Because when it happened, it was present tense.
I don't understand
him. That's what he says. A name, he calls him the word Ba'im. Hashem Hashem means for the time it was happening, they came. When it happened, they came. And the Torah speaks the time that it happened. So the Torah says the time they came rather than they are coming, I mean, rather than past tense. Okay. The Elish Meis B'nai Yisrael Boi Mitzrayim Yaakov Avonov, Yaakov and his children. Bechor Yaakov Reuven. The firstborn son of Yaakov is Reuven. And now it goes into all the details of the kid. Now, even though the Mefarshim say that after Reuven sinned in the Bilah story, it was taken away from Reuven and was given to Yosef, but as far as everything else was concerned, as firstborn, Reuven was still the Bechor. As far as inheritance and Eretz Yisrael, Yosef got double, Menashe and Ephraim. But like this, Reuven was still the firstborn. Okay, Vnei Reuven, the sons of Reuven, were Chanech, Falu, Chetzin, V'Charmi. Now, the Mefarshim explain, they bring down the Medrashim that discuss the meaning of every name over here. And obviously in this book, he doesn't go through all the names, so we're not going to go through all the names. But each one has its significance. You're talking about the 70 fundamental Jewish souls. The 70 fundamental Jewish souls correspond with the 70 nations. It corresponds with Shivim Panim LaTorah, the 70 ways of deciding Torah. Even though there are 600,000 Jews and there's 600,000 ways of learning Torah, but the elements, so to speak, the fundamental things were the 70 souls. And the Rebbe is going to explain later that the 70th, there's three opinions who the 70th was. Yaakov, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or Yocheved. According to Rashi, the 70th was Yocheved. And the Rebbe mentions in many sichas, you see over here the greatness of a Jewish baby. The kid is not even a day old, just born, and it finalizes and sums up and completes the number 70, which was the complete number of the Jewish nation. Which shows that a Jew is a Jew, no matter who they are. A baby a day old, an hour old, doesn't understand anything. Yet, not only are they counted as a Jew, but they... Right, but they're counted as the 70th, the ultimate level. Okay, now the Mefarshim say as follows. Chaneich. Why was he called Chaneich? Chaneich comes to the word chinuch, education. He was named, it says in the Medrash, after the original Chaneich. So Alekim Chaneich went in the ways of God. He was involved in chinuch and education. Palu means, as the Mefarshim explained, destruction. This Palu was the grandfather of Dasan and Aviram. Okay, Uvnei Falu Eliyav, Eliyav who had Nemuel, and Dasan and Aviram, okay, were the biggest troublemakers for the Jews. So Falu means destruction, because he was the grandfather of Dasan and Aviram, who were the ultimate levels of destruction for the Jewish people. Huh? The Unklus calls destruction as Uspali. So in Aramaic, it means destruction. Chetzin and Charmi were both born after the story of Bilhah, when Reuven's birthright was taken away from him. So Chetzin means deprivation, deprived from something. And Kera means shame. So it means Reuven was deprived of the firstborn and he was shamed and so on. So this is Reuven's kids. Uvnei Shimon, the children of Shimon, were Yemuel, Yamin, Ayad, V'yachin, V'tzeichar. Okay? V'shol ben Haknanis. Now, who is Shol ben Haknanis? There's different interpretations. Rashi learns here, Shol ben Haknanis was the daughter of Dinah. We'll soon see about that. Other Mefarshim learn that Shimon married a girl from Canaan, and Yaakov Avinu was upset with it. The other girls, the other Shvatim didn't marry girls from Canaan. Shimon was the first one to marry a girl from Canaan, and therefore he's mentioned as Shol ben Haknanis, so to speak, in a derogatory way.
About Yehuda.
Huh? They say, but he was first. That's what they say. He was the first one to do it.
Reuben was first?
Yeah.
Reuben married before Yehuda?
Shimon.
Shimon.
Shimon married before
Yehuda? Why not? Yeah. Normally the older ones go first. Huh? Yeah, I mean, why, you know. Okay. Then it says, who is the Canaanite refers to Dinah. Now what happened was, when Shechem raped Dinah, she became pregnant. And she was embarrassed to leave because she knew nobody would marry her. So she refused to leave until Shimon promised to marry her. So the obvious question that everybody asks is, how is it possible you marry your sister? It was from the same mother and the same father. It was from Yaakov and Leah. And how is it possible that Shimon would be allowed to marry this girl? Okay, so Rashi says, Rashi doesn't answer the question, but Rashi just says, Bendina Shenivla Laknanik Shogar Shem, Dina didn't want to go out until Shimon promised her he's going to marry her. So the question is, how is it possible to marry a brother and a sister? Even Goyman, I don't have to marry a brother and a sister. No, I'm saying even Seven Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, a Goy also can't marry a sister. In fact, but a Goy couldn't do it even. Seven Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, where everybody had to keep before Matan Torah. They married from the other wives. It was half sister. Yeah, but they didn't marry their own sister. They married from the other one, different mothers.
Shimon would marry the sister
of Don,
not their own sister.
They married their own sister.
Not their own brother.
Half sister.
Half sister they married.
And Adam and Chava, the two brothers.
That'll be four, no.
What are you speaking of, Adam?
First of all, excuse me, 1 second. Excuse me. First of all, let's just get one thing straight. The Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach were not given to Noach. The Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach were given to Adam. But six of them were given to Adam. Okay, the seventh was given to Noach after the flood. When they were allowed to eat meat, Hashem said, you can't have him in a chai, a live limb off an animal. But the Rambam says, from the Gemara, that Adam Rishon and Stava Sheish Mitzvahs, Adam Rishon was commanded on six mitzvahs, which included adultery. Okay? Now, one of the laws of adultery is that a brother can't marry a sister, correct? Which even B'nai Noach is obligated.
Was not
no. She was his back-to-back twin. Siamese twin. Now, obviously, how did Cain marry his sister and Hevel marry his sister if it's the same father and the same mother? The answer is, the same God that said for future generations you can't do it, the same God says you guys do it because there's basically no choice. Right? Not, that doesn't mean if a person has no choice they can transgress Torah. But obviously Hashem said to them, marry your sister. Now, it could be Cain married Hevel's sister, and Hevel married Cain. That could also be. Okay? has two sisters. That's what they were fighting over. They're fighting over.
As everybody married the sister that they was born with, yeah?
Lav Dafka, maybe they married the other one. There was one left over, so Shaila, who's going to get her?
Uh-huh.
Now, so therefore, obviously, the concept of Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Nerech over here in this case would apply even in the times of other Medishim. But the reason they married the sister was because there was no choice. The obvious question over here is, how can Shimon marry Dina if it's mamash inyan of adultery, incest? So the Mefarshim answer, the basic answer of the Mefarshim is, like the Rebbe answers about Bila and Zilpa, Yaakov married Rachel and Leah were two sisters. But then Bila and Zilpa were also sisters. So the question, how do you marry Bila and Zilpa? We learned he married Rachel because he promised her he has to marry her. Okay, but how did he marry Bila and Zilpa? So the Rebbe explains in the Sicha that because they became slaves, in the olden times, slaves lost their personal identity. They did not have any more a yachas, an identity, as a son or a daughter. They became a new entity called a slave, and they lost their previous entity. When Dina was taken captive by Shechem, so basically she became a din of a shivcha, of a maidservant, a slave, and therefore she lost her identity. This is the way the Mefarshim answer. She lost her identity as an individual daughter of Yaakov. So therefore when Shimon came to marry Dina, halachically it wasn't his sister anymore. There's a similar din, but different. According to halacha today, if two goyim, a brother and a sister, convert, according to Torah law, they can marry each other because they're not related. If a mother and a son convert, in Torah law, the son can marry his mother. But halacha says, you can't do it. Why can't you do it? Because it doesn't look nice. As goyim, they couldn't do it, and now as Jews, they could do it. It doesn't look nice to the world. So Torah says you can't do it. But technically, a brother and a sister who both converted technically don't have a din of brother and a sister, because once they become a Jew, they become a new identity. A new entity and a new identity. That's one of the reasons why, according to many opinions, including the Rebbe, that if somebody is adopting children, which besides all the complications and shyness of adopting, there are many opinions that say it's better to adopt a non-Jewish child and convert them than to adopt a Jewish child. Unless if you know for sure who the parents are. Why is that? Because when this kid grows up, you don't know, this kid might end up marrying a sister, a brother. You don't know, because you don't know who the parents are, you don't know who the family is. So I'm saying, if you know who you're adopting the kid from, you know the parents, so then you're careful later on to find out that there's no relations. But otherwise, if a child is going to grow up and you don't know who the birth parents are, the biological parents are, and the kid grows up, and then it's a possibility he might marry a brother and a sister. If you ever read the story of the Golem, in the book the Golem, there's a whole story of the Menami Prag. The Menami Prag was about to do a wedding of a brother and a sister, and the cup fell out of his hand twice. The Menachem Prague understood there was something wrong with the wedding, and he got the Golem to check into it, and he found out they were talking brothers and sisters. Mm. Okay, because the whole story would happen. There's a lot of stories told with other tzaddikim that a kid was left behind in a pit when they saved the family, and the kid ended up marrying, about to marry the sister, whatever. There's a whole, many, many stories about that. So if you adopt a non-Jewish child, and you convert the child, so even if by some freak incident that the sibling of that person was always also converted, let's say, it's still halachically not a problem because they're not brothers and sisters anymore. So according to halacha, over here the commentaries explain that Shimon and Dina became no more, she became unsistered of Shimon because of her shivcha status or slave status, and therefore he was allowed to marry her. It's all a lot of fun, but that's the bottom line of it.
Well,
what?
They look like each other, no? Are they like
I wasn't there to tell you if Dean and Shimon looked alike.
They don't look like each other. Maybe they're not like sisters and brothers, because God just got them to...
You know, I know a lot of brothers and sisters that not only they don't look like, they don't even talk to each other. I know twins that couldn't even pass for brothers and sisters. Twins couldn't even pass for brothers and sisters.
Yeah, but don't they have the same genes?
I guess they do, so.
So how is it like if they are going and they convert, so suddenly the genes change?
It's a new person.
Okay, the neshama is new, but then the genes...
The halachically, the person is a brand new person. That's the halach.
What about the cloning
really
people, their brother, sister?
Advantage, they convert, they
probably
choose,
not.
And they can marry each other.
Yeah, but Halacha says no, because as Goyim they couldn't, it doesn't look right to do as Jews.
Yeah, but the Halacha still says it's allowed.
It's
not good to do it, but it's allowed.
No, Halacha says you're not allowed to do it because it doesn't look right. But besides, right. But besides that, technically, theoretically, it would be allowed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But not... Okay, B'nai Levi... The sons of Levi were Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. Gershon, and obviously Kohath was the grandfather of Moshe Rabbeinu, and Merari. Now, why does it say over here that Kohath was one of the people that went into Mitzrayim to figure out that when Hashem told Avraham Avinu that the Jews are going to be slaves in Egypt 400 years, and at the end of when the Jews left Egypt, according to just the calculation of how many years Kohath lived, and Amram lived, and Moshe lived, it was impossible to have the 400 years, if you had all the years together. So that's how we know when the Torah is teaching us that Kohath, one of the proofs the Gemara says, from the fact that Kohath came down to Egypt, shows that the Jews couldn't have been in Egypt 400 years. Because if you take Kohath's years, and Amram's years, and Moshe's years together, it still wouldn't equal 400. Plus, a lot of years are overlapping one another. Huh? Yitzchok. What? Time from the birth of Yitzchok, yeah.
Ishai.
Now, huh?
Ishai. Ishai lived 400 years.
Two opinions, 80 or 200, or 400. Two versions in the Rashi later on the Chumash.
I read that he lived 400 years.
Yeah, one opinion says 400 years, one opinion says 80. Big difference, but that's
okay.
That's what
Mashiach
has to come here. Now,
soon,
huh?
Soon,
he came already.
Yeah, but
he's
soon it's happening.
He's hidden.
Gershon, Kohath, and Merari in Chassidus it explains what's the concept of these three names. Gershon comes from the word Gershon, divorce. Shevet Levi was the tribe which was designated to serve Hashem in the Beis HaMikdash. And Rambam writes, not only did Hashem separate the tribe of Levi, but any Jew who dedicates his life for the sake of Torah Mitzvahs is called the tribe of Levi. So Levi basically refers to a nation that dedicates its life to godliness. In order to dedicate your life to godliness, you need three levels: Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. Gershon comes from the word Gershon, divorce. The first thing a person has to do is separate himself from all evil things of the world. Concept of sur meira. Okay, basically, turning away from evil. Gedishin means divorcing yourself from evil. Kohas comes in the word, as later on in Chumash it says, v'lo yikas amim, to him nations will gather. Kohas refers to the level of gathering sparks of Kedusha. That's the concept of asay tev, doing more mitzvahs, gathering, you know, more kedusha. That's the level of asay tev. Merari is the level of merirus, embitterment, not atzus, which is depression, but merirus, that the person is embittered, that he's not the level of kedusha that he should be reaching. So, in order for a person to reach this level of Levi, it says there's three sons: Gershon, Kohath, and Amram, and Merari. Which explains Lucheda Kohath was greater than Gershon, because Kohath was the grandfather of Moshe Rabbeinu, and Kohath were the ones in the Mishkan that carried the Aron, so they were the holiest. So the question is, so then Kohath should be the old, I mean, yeah, Kohath should be the oldest. Why is the level first Gershon, then Kohath, then Merari, if the truth is that the Kohath is greater? So the answer is, because in the order of Aveda, first you need Gershon to separate yourself from evil, then you can come to the level of Kohath, of gathering sparks. You can't put on a clean suit if your body is full of mud. This doesn't work. So you need first Gershon, then Kohath, and then Merari. So therefore, even though Kohath was greater, but level-wise, first you need the Gershon, and then Kohath. Then it says, Ubnei Yehuda, who were the sons of Yehuda? Er v'Einan v'Shalach u'Peretz v'Zarach. Okay, Er, Einan, and Shelah were born to Yehuda's first wife, and the last two, Peretz and Zarach, were the twins, born to Tamar, in the Yehuda-Tamar story. And the pasuk continued, V'Yomis Er v'Einan Beretz Canaan. Er v'Einan died earlier in the land of Canaan, like in the Yehuda-Tamar story. And therefore, it says, Vayiyu b'nei Peretz, the children of Peretz were Chetzrin and Chomu. So you see, the Chetzrin and Chomu were the great-grandchildren of Yaakov Avinu. Mm-hmm. So this time, Yaakov Avinu had great-grandchildren. Well, he was pretty old, he was 130, so it's not hard to have great-grandchildren at 130. Even though he got married at 86, but still. 84, I mean. 84. Got married at 84. Okay, now, he named Chetzron and Chomul. Okay, Chetzron, he says, is the memory of Ed and Einon. See, like, you put it together, Chetzron. And Einon, he said, now Hashem is, Chomul, he said, Hashem has pity on me. Chomul al amelcho is the concept of pity. Okay, now. He brings on over here just the chronological difficulty over here. From the time Yosef was sold until Yaakov came down to Egypt was 22 years. Correct? That we know. From the time Yosef left, Yaakov came down to Egypt was 22 years. Which means, according to the simple chronological order of Chumash, because we learned right after Yosef was sold, the brothers threw Yehuda away. They said it was all your fault. And then he married this Bashua. Then he married the story of Tamar. That means in 22 years, according to the simple pshat of the pasuk, what happened was Yehuda married Shua, had Erva Einan were born. Right, the daughter of Shua, I said. The daughter of Shua. So then Er married Tamar, Er died. Einan married Tamar, Einan died. Tamar remained a widow for 1 year. He married Tamar. And then, okay. Then, Peretz grew up, married, had Chetzron and Chomul. That means in 22 years, Yehuda got married, had two kids, they got married, and had kids. All in 22 years. Huh? Three generations in 22 years. Three generations in 22 years.
Everybody living at age 7.
They're right. According to this Cheshbon, they couldn't have been older. Er, Einan, and Peretz couldn't have been older than 8 years old when they got married. And he writes, not unusual in biblical times. That means it was... But just figure out, three generations were born in 22 years. So? Now we can't understand it. It's just something which is not common today. It's just something not common. Right, but over there was a whole different the concept of slavery and everything.
You know, when a woman has treatment with hormones, it's always 6, 7 uparim. They take it out.
When what?
Hormone.
Not always it is 6 or 7. No.
Usually 4.
No. Sometimes 2, sometimes 3. I'm saying before they take out, they take out, but sometimes 2 or 3 or 4. It's not necessarily. Okay, just one more positive. Okay, you know what? B'nei Yisachar, Telo, Fuva, Yev, Shimrein. Zvulun was said at Eilani Yachlel. And then it says, okay, we'll leave this pasuk the next time.